You're listening to WRFG Atlanta, 89.3 FM, your station for progressive information. WRFG provides a voice for those who have been traditionally denied access to broadcast media through the involvement of a broad base of community elements to guarantee that access. In the utilization of the Foundation's facilities and in its programs, the following communities will receive first priority: those who continue to be denied free and open access to the broadcast media, and those who suffer oppression or exploitation based upon class, race, sex, age, creed, disability, sexual orientation, or immigrant status.
Opinions expressed on WRFG do not necessarily represent the opinions of Radio Free Georgia Broadcasting Foundation, Inc., its staff or volunteers. And you are listening to Alternative Perspectives, the weekly program about the GLBTQI community, produced by Betty Kuvitier. Alternative Perspectives is about the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, queer questioning, and intersex community, informing about the issues that affect us and our allies, and the common humanity that connects us all. And I am your host, Betty.
Hello, 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 and good evening. And this is Alternative Perspectives on WRFG 89.3 FM, to the left of your radio dial. And we are going to have, in a little bit, we'll have our production team that we'll be calling in. Becky will be on the telephone this week. Nancy will be calling in from Sacramento. Donner is in the studio tonight. And we have a newcomer that hopefully will join us if we don't scare her away, frighten her or anything. She is new to Atlanta, talented and very professional. Bridie Mae Johnson, who just arrived from Detroit, Michigan. And hello, Bridie.
Hello.
And then we're going to have Nancy will conduct an interview with Melissa Hart, who is the author of Gringa. And you'll find that very interesting. Right now, we're going to give you an update on the national news from This Way Out, and it's quite interesting. Okay, so tune in for that, and we'll be back after the news.
It's absolutely one of the most important trials of my life.
There is no fundamental right to same-sex marriage.
We know that justice and love ultimately will prevail in this cause.
There was definitely homophobia and prejudice along the way, but it never stopped us from writing what we wanted to write, making the records we wanted to make. And now it's just so grateful to just be part of the movement. There's a lot of work left to be done, and we're just happy to be out and playing music as being who we are.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Proposition 8 gets another day in court. Gays get their party started in the Philippines. And the Indigo Girls redeclare their independence. All that and a lot more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
And I'm Christopher Gall.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending January 16, 2010. The much-anticipated U.S. federal court trial testing the constitutionality of California's Proposition 8, known as Perry v. Schwarzenegger, began on January 11th with testimony from the case's two plaintiff same-gender couples. I've been in love with a woman for 10 years, said 45-year-old Kristen Perry, and I don't have access to a word for it. Her partner, 47-year-old Sandra Steer, and Paul Latami and Jeffrey Zerillo, each in his 30s, want to overturn the November 2008 voter-approved initiative that outlawed same-gender civil marriage in the Golden State. Latami testified that he and Zerillo haven't pursued fatherhood because they want their children to have the stability and protections that only come with marriage. The opening statement by attorney Theodore Olson, who with David Boies represents the two couples, referenced an earlier U.S. Supreme Court decision that Marriage is the most important relationship in life and of fundamental importance to all individuals. Adding to the high-profile nature of the case, Olson represented George W. Bush and Boies represented Al Gore in the 2000 Supreme Court case that gave Bush the presidency. They've said they're working together because the issue is neither conservative nor liberal, but one of fairness and equality. Attorney Charles Cooper, who represents Proposition 8 backers, said in his opening statement that California's domestic partner laws already grant same-gender couples virtually all of the state's marriage rights except the name. He also claimed that it's too difficult to know how lesbian and gay matrimony would affect so-called traditional marriage because the practice is still so new.
Expert testimony ranging from changes in the way society has viewed marriage to the historical discrimination faced by lesbians and gay men in the United States was then solicited by attorneys for the plaintiffs. The headline maker was the deposition recorded last month by Haksheng William Tam, a defendant in the case because he was one of the named leaders of the Prop 8 campaign. He had sent a letter to Chinese American church groups warning that marriage equality was just part of a larger so-called gay agenda that included legalizing having sex with children. He also wrote that other states would fall into Satan's hands if gays and lesbians weren't prevented from marrying in California. The plaintiff attorneys introduced the footage to support one of their arguments in the case, that Proposition 8 is unconstitutional because it was fueled by deep-seated animosity toward a recognized minority. Prop 8 defense attorney David Thompson countered with statements from President Barack Obama that favored civil unions over civil marriage for same-gender couples as an example of how one could oppose marriage equality without being discriminatory.
Chief San Francisco economist Edmund Egan discussed the loss of tax revenue and commercial business income because of the ban. A Columbia University social scientist then testified about the negative impact of the ban on the health of gays and lesbians. He said that the ban contributed to the social stigma that makes gays and lesbians more susceptible to substance abuse, depression, and suicide. A Cambridge University professor also discussed gay and lesbian parenting and how marriage equality benefits the children of same-gender couples.
The trial is expected to take at least 2 weeks. Whoever loses in the non-jury trial, being heard in San Francisco by Chief U.S. District Judge Vaughn R. Walker, is certain to appeal. Most believe the case will eventually reach the U.S. Supreme Court. A ruling there that Proposition 8 does indeed violate the U.S. Constitution's promise of equal protection could overturn all state laws, including voter-approved measures in 31 states that ban same-gender marriage.
2 hours before the trial was scheduled to begin, the U.S. Supreme Court approved a temporary restraining order sought by Prop 8 defenders, which the justices made permanent 2 days later, overturning Judge Walker's approval of televising the proceedings in other federal court buildings and posting video of the trial on YouTube. Prop 8 backers claimed that such coverage would intimidate witnesses who might feel threatened by widespread exposure. The high court split 5-4 along its well-established conservative and liberal leanings. But Lambda Legal's marriage project director, Jenny Pizer, cautioned that the decision was strictly procedural and not necessarily a predictor of a ruling on Proposition 8 itself. But some legal scholars criticized the Supreme Court's decision as highly unusual micromanagement of rules that district courts have generally been allowed to establish for themselves.
In a second queer-related decision late this week, the High Court agreed to hear the appeal by marriage equality opponents of a ruling to allow the public disclosure of the names and addresses of some 138,000 people who signed petitions to restrict the rights of domestic partners in the state of Washington. Voters rejected that November 2009 ballot initiative, but its proponents claim that release of the names could lead to intimidation, harassment, or threats against those who signed the qualifying petitions.
In other legal news this week, the Philippines Supreme Court issued a temporary restraining order preventing the country's Elections Commission from barring the LGBT group Ang Lalad from registering as a political party and fielding candidates in upcoming national elections. The commission denied recognition to Ang Lalad in November because the group promotes immorality. The High Court said it issued the temporary order to allow potential Ang Lalad candidates to be listed on the May 2010 ballot, though they could be disallowed if its final ruling upholds the commission decision.
A Superior Court judge in Washington, D.C. ruled that opponents of the new marriage equality law there don't have a right to hold a public referendum to repeal it. Judge Judith N. Macaluso agreed with the D.C. Board of Elections and Ethics, which twice said that such a move would violate a city law prohibiting a public vote on a matter covered by the Human Rights Act, which outlaws discrimination against gay men and lesbians and other minority groups. Maryland preacher Harry Jackson of Hope Christian Church, who leads the group opposing the new law, vowed to appeal the ruling. City leaders say that, barring a successful appeal or intervention by Congress during the review period it has for D.C. legislation, marriage licenses will be available to same-gender couples around the first week of March.
A psychologist evaluating the man charged in Puerto Rico with brutally murdering gay teenager Jorge Steven Lopez Mercado told a judge this week that the defendant is mentally competent to stand trial. Juan José Martínez Matos is accused of murdering 19-year-old López Mercado in November by burning, decapitating, and dismembering his body before leaving it on the side of a road. Local authorities say prosecuting Martínez Matos under the territory's gay-inclusive hate crimes legislation, which passed in 2002, may be the first use of that law.
The trial of two gay men in Malawi for holding a public engagement party was postponed this week after one of the defendants collapsed in court, according to a report in the Times of London. Tuwangi Chimbalanga, who spent more than a week in one of the African country's most congested prisons, vomited and stumbled onto the dusty court floor just before the case was due to start. Chimbalanga and his partner Stephen Manjeza, who's also been jailed, have each been charged with unnatural practices between men and gross public indecency, which is punishable by up to 14 years in prison. Chimbalanga's lawyers told the packed court that he had severe malaria and needed more time to rest before the case could resume. The chief resident magistrate at the court in Blantyre ordered that Chimbalanga be hospitalized for treatment and adjourn the trial until January 25th.
Elsewhere, police entered an upscale restaurant and club in Beijing on January 15th to prevent the start of a Mr. Gay China contest just hours before it was scheduled to begin. Organizers said police told them that they did not have the proper permits. Contestants in the first ever such event in China, which would have included question and answer and fashion and underwear segments, were to vie for the right to represent China at the worldwide Mr. Gay pageant in Norway next month. It received considerable advance media coverage, even in the state-run press, which earlier in the week ran a front-page story with photos about a gay male couple's wedding ceremony, also touted as a first for China, though such unions are not legal there. The recent relatively positive press coverage seemed to underscore a growing openness about homosexuality in the country. China's first officially sanctioned Gay Pride Festival was held last June in Shanghai, although authorities canceled a few related events at the last minute. The country's first government-backed gay bar opened in the tourist town of Dali in southwestern Yunnan province last month in a bid to boost HIV/AIDS prevention efforts. Ryan Dutcher, one of the organizers of the now-canceled Mr. Gay China pageant, told Agence France-Presse that, "I'm very disappointed, but I can't say I'm very surprised."
And finally, an LGBT advocacy group has rejected a cease and desist demand over the logo in its online coverage of the Perry v. Schwarzenegger trial that parodies the one used by ProtectMarriage.com during the battle over Proposition 8. The original logo of Prop 8 backers featured figures of a man and a woman with two small children. The Courage Campaign's trial tracker mimics that logo, but depicts two women and two children. ProtectMarriage.com claims copyright infringement because, their letter charged, the trial tracker logo is substantially indistinguishable from theirs. In a press release, Courage campaign leader Rick Jacobs said that, "We are heartened that Prop 8 supporters now acknowledge that a family of two women and two children are no different than a family headed by a man and a woman. I certainly hope," he added, "that they will acknowledge that fact in Judge Vaughn Walker's courtroom."
That's News Wrap for the week ending January 16th, 2010, written by Greg Gordon and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. You can read the text of this week's News Wrap online at www.thiswayout.org.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community. For This Way Out, I'm Christopher Gall.
And I'm Tanya Kane Perry.
In concert with communities around the world, LGBT groups are coming out in support of the earthquake survivors in Haiti. A coalition of organizations led by Canvas for a Cause is raising funds online for the American Red Cross via the website www.gaygroupsgiveback.org. Queer travel companies Atlantis Events, RSVP Vacations, and Olivia Cruises have each pledged $7,500 to the Red Cross, and you can find out about Olivia's free cruise offers for other $7,500 donors at www.olivia.com. The predominantly LGBT Metropolitan Community Church is targeting disaster relief funds to Haitian members of its Dominican congregation and to its HIV/AIDS partner organization in Haiti. Log on to www.mccchurch.org. And the International Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission is facilitating earthquake relief with other local Haitian LGBT groups. Find out more at its website, www.iglhrc.org.
Alrighty, and now for a word from WRFG, and we'll be right back.
Sac passé.
Maboule.
WRFG wishes to express our heartfelt sorrow for the loss and pain caused by the 7.0 Richter scale earthquake that hit Haiti on January 12th that has left millions adversely affected. In response to this great tragedy, WRFG is working with the Haitian Alliance to help provide relief for the victims in Haiti. WRFG is a collection location for the earthquake relief drive. We are collecting these necessary relief items: water purification tablets, medical supplies, for example, first aid kits, antibiotics, etc. Meals ready to eat, non-perishable items, tents, cots, pillows, sheets and blankets, toiletries, body bags. WRFG is not collecting financial donations. More information on financial donations and updates on the relief efforts are on the Haitian Alliance website, transformhaiti.org. WRFG is an official collection location for the Haiti earthquake. Please bring donated items listed above to WRFG Radio Monday through Friday, 11 a.m. until 6 p.m. at 1083 Austin Avenue, Atlanta, Georgia, 30307. For more information, you may also call 404-523-3471 or go to WRFG.org. Let's do our part.
Okay, and with all our duties out of the way, we do have on the line Becky and Nancy are there. Hi.
Hey.
Hi.
Okay, and I'd like to introduce you to Bridie Mae Johnson, who has joined us here in the studio. And say Nancy?
Yes.
Becky?
Hey,
I introduce you to Bridie.
Hi, Bridie. How are you?
Good. How are you?
Nice. How are you doing?
Pretty good. Nice to meet you both.
Okay, great. And Donna is here in the studio with us.
Hi, hey, gals.
Donna. Hey, Donna.
Hello.
All righty. We got the team. It's all here. That's all a good thing. Yes, yes, yes. And in a little bit, we're going to have Nancy conducting an interview with Melissa Hart, the author of Gringa. Am I correct?
Yes, Gringa, A Contradictory Childhood.
Okay, and it's all about she was raised by her dad. Is that what it is?
Yeah, it's an incredibly well-written, it's almost poetic, it's so beautifully written. It's a memoir of how, when her mother came out as a lesbian in the 70s, her father and the court system basically took the children, her and her two siblings, away from their mom, and they only saw their mom, I think, once or twice each month. And so the father was allowed to raise them because they didn't believe two women could raise children.
In the 70s. Okay.
Hmm. Yeah.
Well, well, well.
That's reminiscent of
And this was our way of California, right?
Yeah, surprisingly.
Surprisingly in California, my goodness. Okay, I mean, the 70s was just about the time I came out, you know. I took my child with me, though. You know what I mean?
Yeah. You raised two kids.
Yeah. But, wow, in the 70s. And the ports just simply eliminated the mom, more or less, huh?
Yeah, it was a forced separation. Mm. And as a mom, I really can't quite wrap my brain around it, but I've dealt with the court systems here in California, and they're not always the best.
Not always the best, huh? Okay. No. Well, hopefully we can get directly from her, you know, and her impressions, and you know what made her write the book.
Exactly.
And what did she want to get out here to the folks, and what the message is. Yeah, it's going to be an interesting conversation. In the meantime, anything on Enda?
Well, I'm rooting for Martha Coakley here, Betty, in Massachusetts, because
that's strictly your opinion, and not that of WRFG.
Yeah, well, only because of the fact that the U.S. Senate seat that was vacated by the late Ted Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
Today's special election is being held in Massachusetts. In fact, the polls are closed now, so we ought to be getting results.
Soon. Nothing's come up yet?
Nothing's come up yet. I haven't heard any, but it's just 20 minutes after the polls closing.
Yeah,
so,
yeah.
But that is a critical vote for pro-LGBT issues that will come up in the Senate, such as Enda.
Yeah. But you know what I've been wondering?
What?
You know, because when it came to, you know, the health care issue.
Yeah.
You know, the health care issue, it was an agreement between the Republicans and the Democrats that they needed 60 votes.
Right.
The kind of vote it is and the kind of legislation it is, that 60 votes is not required. It's only 51 that's required.
Correct.
But for whatever reason, you know, that they call themselves negotiating. They put themselves in this predicament, you know, where they wouldn't have the 60 votes for health care if the Democrats lose.
Right.
Okay.
Right. And that's the lead. That's the lead on the election in Massachusetts. Is that this is a critical vote for the health care reform act? But from
I just get curious. You see, and I head down that line of okay. So what was the plan? Okay, I want to know what the plan was. I want to know why they did this agreement. Okay, and I can use the I'll use the words and quote unquote the conspiracy behind it. You know what? That's where my mind goes. I said, why would they put themselves in that situation if all they needed was 51 votes to agree on a 60 vote?
Well,
what?
It's this little kabuki dance that's being done in the Senate.
The little who?
Kabuki dance.
Kabuki. Okay.
Little kabuki dance. All
righty for the kabuki dance. Okie dokie.
Well, I mean, you know, put your toe in, take your toe out. It's this little kabuki dance.
Okay.
Of 60 votes is what's needed to reach to break a filibuster.
Uh huh.
So that's always, and you have to have those 60 votes to invoke cloture to take a bill to a final vote.
But they didn't have to worry about a filibuster if they hadn't agreed on the thing for the vote itself to be 60.
Yeah. Hey, Betty.
Yeah.
You know it's crazy up there.
Yeah, okay. Am I trying to make something logical out of something that is just totally illogical and you can't make sense of?
Yeah,
I mean, no matter how long you talk about it, it's still not going to make sense.
A rational reason. I think they put out rational reasons.
They do. They do. When?
Well, I'm putting that in air quotes.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You know.
Those are in quotes too. Okay.
Yeah. They put out that rational reason, but really, it's just this back and forth dance that they've got going on. I swear to God, if anybody saw Jon Stewart last night, you would have laughed about it because he made a plea to the Democrats of what's wrong with you people. You know, like. The fact that George Bush had the Republican Congress didn't have as big a majority as the Democrats do now, and George Bush got everything done that he wanted done. But now that the Democrats are in power, there's this tenuous constant. You know, they got to have a wider margin on the voting tallies to be able to get enough votes to pass a bill. Well,
yeah, let's give you both our feet so we can shoot both of them.
Yeah,
you know?
Exactly. I mean, it's just crazy. In fact, John Stewart made the point last night that the Democrats are in a higher majority right now in Congress than the Republicans have been since 1923.
Still can't get the work.
Still can't get it going. It's like, wake up, you know, take a stand, do it, you know.
Well, you know, and it is kind of scary to be in this position because this is huge, and if it doesn't go through, it pretty much will probably, change the course of the term of Barack Obama for the rest of the 4 years, and probably, you know, he's finished, you know what I mean, if this doesn't get passed, so.
Yeah, that's a lot. I agree with you, Donna, that a lot of the political pundits that I have been following have basically made this it's got to pass to save the president, you know,
mm-hmm.
to save his political capital.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So they're kind of, that's really a shame that it's hinged on that.
It's so early on, too. I mean, this was huge. This was major. And I just don't understand why the Democrats just don't seem to learn from the mistakes previously made. I mean, you know, the Clintons went down this road with trying to do health care reform, and, you know, it didn't go anywhere really quickly. And it just doesn't seem like they learned a lesson from any of that. I don't know. But, you know, why people go into politics anyway in the first place is beyond me. So, for Betty and Becky and everybody else, I wanted to be able to give some information, too, about another organization that I know is collecting money for Haitian relief, and that would be Rainbow World Fund. And, you know,
okay,
that's the organization,
right,
that I've been to two trips to Guatemala with. And Rainbow World Fund is founded by a gay man, and it's a gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender organization that funds aid relief throughout the world, but not necessarily to other LGBT organizations. In other words, their credo is, you know, being able to give money and aid where it's needed and let the folks who are receiving it know that it came from the LGBT community. So it's another way of spreading education as well as spreading goodwill. So www.rainbowfund.org.
Okay, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
All right. We have some... it's Donna ringing in her pocket. All right. Nancy, we have Melissa on the line. Hi, Melissa. This is Betty, and you were just listening to Donna Nalucci. She's part of the production team, and we have Bridie Mae Johnson in the studio also, and Becky Jane Harrelson is on the other line, and she's part of the production team also. But Nancy will be asking you the questions, I guess. We'll be carrying on a conversation with you once the initial stuff is out of the way. Okay?
Okay, that sounds great. Hi.
Hi, and welcome to WRFG 89.3 and Alternative Perspectives. Thank you for your time. Nancy, you want to take it?
Yes, well, welcome, Melissa. I'm very excited and honored that you're our guest tonight, so thank you for, appearing on air.
Well, sure, thank you. It's a pleasure.
Well, for our listeners, tell them a little bit about yourself and about how you came to write Gringa.
All right. Well, I teach journalism at the University of Oregon, and a class in Introduction to Memoir Writing for UC Berkeley's online extension program. And I wrote my first memoir, The Assault of Laughter, as a master's thesis at Goddard College a little over a decade ago. And I felt that the story I had to tell was important enough that I should tell it better the second time around. So about 4 years ago, I started the manuscript that is now Gringa, A Contradictory Girlhood, which Seal Press published last October.
Wonderful.
Tell you a little bit about it. My sort of elevator pitch to people is that Gringa is the story of growing up white, straight, and boring in multicultural Los Angeles with lesbian moms, a brother with Down syndrome, and a deep desire to be a Latina.
It's a wonderful, wonderful book, and I have so many questions that I wanted to ask you.
Oh, sure.
I guess the first question I wanted to know, because I have so many questions about your mom.
Uh-huh.
How long did she know that she was a lesbian, and what was the impetus that finally led her to leave her marriage and to live openly?
Well, she had fallen in love with my younger brother's bus driver, a woman, and I think she realized this about 6 months before she came out of the closet. She took her kids. I have two younger siblings. She took us with her and left my father, who was pretty volatile and abusive. She took us and left to live with this woman. And so I think she was just coming into an awareness of her sexuality in about the 6 months before she came out.
Okay. Now, what was her emotional fallout after the court's decision to give custody to your father and basically to enforce a separation between you and your siblings and your mother?
Right. Well, it was pretty grim. I mean, what the court said was that she was unfit to parent. We had all gone to a social worker and a psychologist who determined that it was better to live with our father than to live with our mother and her new partner. And the court told us that we could only see her 2 weekends a month and then a month during the summer. And she was absolutely devastated. I was quite young. My sister was 7. My brother was 5. And he is developmentally disabled. And so he was essentially still a toddler. And so this was absolutely devastating. I hate to speak too much for her. Hopefully, one of these days, she'll write about it herself.
That would be a wonderful book to read.
I
have
so
a couple
too.
Of questions that Becky Jane sent me. Were you ever harassed or bullied in school or in general for having a lesbian mom? And if so, what happened?
Yeah, I was. This was, I think, about the 6th grade. You know, I've written essays about this for The Oregonian and for The Advocate. Pretty much the worst thing you could call somebody, let's see, that would have been in the early 80s, was either fag or lesbo. And my babysitter's daughter was my age and got a hold of the fact that I had a lesbian mom and spread it around school. And so I did get teased a little bit and actually got into a fight with a girl over it. That sort of thing went away in high school, though, which was refreshing. But still, you know, I was talking to a group, Legal Voice in Seattle, a group of women and particularly lesbian activists and moms last week, and we were talking about how even if there were queer spawn children of same-sex parents at my high school, we were all so closeted I didn't even know about it.
Mm-hmm. What was your mom's response? Did she know that you had been bullied when you were younger?
No, I didn't tell her. You know, I think I really took on the role of protector in that relationship, and I didn't want to tell her that at the time.
One question I have about your father, has your father ever regretted his part in the estrangement in your childhood between you and your mom?
Again, it's difficult to say. I cannot speak for him, and we've been estranged for almost 20 years. I sincerely doubt it. I think, you know, he's a Baptist, and he really believes that what he did was right. And again, I don't want to put words into his mouth, but I think he is still convinced that his actions were completely justified.
Okay. Well, let me change questioning.
Sure.
You incorporate a lot of wonderful recipes into the book, and they're written with such humor. Tell me why you decided to incorporate the recipes. How that added to your memoir.
Oh, sure. I really, really fell in love with books that included recipes when I first came across Laura Esquivel's Like Water for Chocolate. And I loved how the recipes in that novel became an extension of the chapters themselves and also lent insight into the characters and their emotions and relationships. And then I came across Diana Abu-Jaber's The Language of Baklava after it was published, and she does the same thing. She puts in a lot of recipes, and, you know, they're all germane to the chapters that precede them. And I started reading Ruth Reichel's book, Tender at the Bone, which does much the same thing. And I had all of these recipes from my childhood, and food was really, really important to me as a child and as an adolescent. So I wanted to include these, particularly the Frito boat recipe, which you know, my book trailer is centered around. And it was my husband's idea to write them in the narrative. Originally, I had just put them as recipes that you might find in a cookbook. But he said, I think these would be much more fun in narrative. And of course they are.
They're wonderful. And tell the readers what a Frito boat is.
A Frito boat. That's funny. I had to describe this to an MFA program over the weekend as well. So you take your snack-sized bag of Frito corn chips and you cut it down. You hold it in one hand and then you spoon warm chili over the top of the Fritos and top it with shredded cheese. And if you want to be a show-off, some chopped olives and cilantro. And then you eat this right out of the bag with a spoon.
I saw your video, Melissa. It was really enjoyable.
It's delicious, but I do want to recommend to listeners that they don't eat this in the desert, because my husband and I ate the Frito boats in the desert a couple of years ago, and we almost died from the salt.
All right. Can I ask a question here?
Yes. Jump in, Betty.
Okay. Melissa, getting down, you know, getting away from, you know, the subject of your mom.
Uh-huh.
Okay, you yourself, when you were as young as you were when all this separation occurred, what were your thoughts? What were you thinking? You know, how did you feel?
I was young and didn't have a lot of information about what was going on. I was a pretty naive child.
Mm-hmm.
And so really hadn't investigated my own sexuality, much less thought about it in terms of my parents.
Mm-hmm.
So at first, I did not understand why we had been taken away. My father and the judge had essentially told us that our mother was mentally ill, that she was sick.
Mm-hmm.
And I just didn't understand where they got off saying this, because previous to her leaving, she had been the leader of our brownie troop and driven the carpool, and she'd kind of been a model suburban housewife.
Mm.
And so, you know, with the accompanying wardrobe. So I didn't understand what was going on. And about, I would say, a year, maybe 6 months after she lost custody of us, she came out to me and explained, and, you know, it still took a couple of years to really understand the homophobia that had propelled the court's decision.
Mm. Wow. Okay.
Mm. And I think it's important to note, you know, I don't know how
where
much...
Did you get, where did you see your mom? Did you visit with her where she lived, or did you met somewhere? She took you out for the day, or, you know, how was that, the visit?
Well, yeah, actually both. I want to before I answer that, I also want to say to listeners who don't necessarily know this,
mm-hmm.
that this was the plight of lesbian mothers in the 1970s and early 1980s. They regularly lost custody of their kids when they came out. And this is documented in a wonderful documentary that came out in 2006, I believe, called Mom's Apple Pie, the story of the Lesbian Mothers National Defense Fund, which I was a part of. And so I just thought that was important to note. But no, my mom would come and pick us up every other weekend and take us to her house, which was about 90 miles away. And then when I got older, she would come down to Los Angeles and spend a day with me.
Mm-hmm. So you were in the house where she lived with her partner, a lover, or?
Yes, exactly.
Okay.
I find it interesting simply because during that period of time in the 70s and 80s, I was raising children also, and I had, you know, I was separated from my husband, and I didn't experience any of that, you know, and it's you know, but I didn't experience a lot of stuff that I've learned after, you know, my raising of children and whatnot. I raised my children in a very conservative area, never got any backlash from what I could tell, you know, and even speaking to my daughter today, I mean, they didn't get any backlash in school. Both my partner and I at the time, we each had a child, and we raised them since they were 6 and 8, my daughter being the older. And it just, and you know, we just gave statistics out. I missed all that. Yeah, I'm glad. You know, I'm happy that I missed all that. You know, because,
I am too.
You know, because I didn't have to experience all that, and my child didn't have to experience all that. You know, her dad was always a part of her life, then and now, and there was none of that homophobic kind of speeches, or you know, telling them this or telling them that, especially that they told you that your mom was mentally ill. You know, that's, yeah, I think that's terrible. I was on the East Coast in New York, in upstate New York, and I'm just amazed at your story and what you went through personally.
Yeah, the irony is that this was in Southern California, which is supposed to be so liberal.
It's supposed to be the liberal place.
Right.
Yeah.
Not so much.
Yeah. It's, wow.
You know, but also during the time of the 70s, this is Donna, I was growing up in Miami, and of course, in Miami-Dade in particular, is when there was the referendum to not allow
the orange juice.
Yeah, Anita Bryant, you know, went on her campaign about gay teachers and wanted to ban any openly gay teachers, and you know, she came down and you know, did her thing, and and the gay people threw oranges at her and stuff. And I wasn't out then because I had only finished high school in 1976, but you know, was becoming aware of myself anyway. So you have that. I think your situation, Betty, is really kind of more unique. I think.
Is it unique?
Yeah, I think.
Because even when I came, you know, even when I came to Atlanta, the whole issue of that, the black and white scene in the gay and lesbian part of our population. I mean, the whole thing of the separation part of it all, you know, when I hit here, and I didn't experience that either. I didn't experience all the labeling in New York, you know. Everybody up there was gay. And all of a sudden down here, I became, I either had to be some kind of a lipstick lesbian or a stud or, you know, something. There was some label that was given. And I didn't experience any of that in New York either. So
you were in a progressive, protective pocket.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I was in a place in upstate New York in Putnam County, which is very Republican. I had neighbors, and my kids played with my neighbors' kids, and they had sleepovers, and you know, it was like there was nobody that was afraid. I was a volunteer up there too. I belonged to the fire department because we had a volunteer fire department. You know, and we were very much accepted, and it was accepted on you know, my partner at the time was black, so it was, you know, we were the salt and pepper team, you know.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, yeah, everybody accepted us, you know. It was country living kind of, you know, place. The girls went to Catholic grammar school, you know, and we were accepted by the Catholic, you know, the priest, and the, you know, whenever anything had to be said or whatever, they said it to either or of us. You know, they didn't ask who had the authority. They, whoever was there, got told whatever had to be told, you know, about either child, you know. So it's so surprising to me, you know, all of this.
Heartbreaking.
And it's heartbreaking. Yes, it is. Because, sure. You know, why would people have to go through this stuff, you know?
But this was probably more common than your experience.
I've learned, you know, from the other stuff in the political area and in the activist stuff, that it was more common mm-hmm. in the other area than it was for me. And, you know, it was a real, real learning experience for me being in the activist and getting involved with the community and all that. And it was like, wow, not telling my parents, not telling my family. I mean, I never experienced it. I just was never in the closet. Okay.
Well, I think that's why it's interesting to hear this story of a mm-hmm. of a young child growing up in this right. environment, being taken away from her mother, being told, you know, mm-hmm. Being told your mom was mentally ill, and then you know, having.
And what I find so interesting is the fact that you're willing to tell the story.
Well, I wanted to talk about that for a minute mm-hmm. too. Mm-hmm. I was with one of the filmmakers of Mom's Apple Pie last weekend,
mm-hmm.
and she made the point to this organization of women that most of the mothers that they tried to interview, most of the adult children that were involved in this did not want to talk about it. There's still so much shame and so much stigma that they had a hard time finding any lesbian moms and offspring to even go on film.
Right.
And I know they approached my mother, and she said, absolutely not, I will not be in your movie.
Mm.
So I just wonder how many moms are still in the closet about what happened back then.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Or how they coped, you know, how they endured.
Yeah.
Did they stay in marriages for the sake of the children? You know,
right.
I mean, your mom did the right thing for her, and, you know, and then her worst fears came true, losing her children. What a horrible thing. Is your mom still alive now?
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Yes,
we're
okay.
Very, very close.
Good. Glad to hear that.
Yeah, she just went on half of the book tour with me, and she upstaged me in the cast room in San Francisco.
Melissa, have you found any other folks that would be willing? I mean, you said that you know, it's hard to find people that'll talk about it, but are you talking about movie rights and all that kind of stuff? I mean,
oh, I am not, although I would dearly love to see Gringa made mm-hmm. into a film with Jodie Foster.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, that would be great.
Wow, wouldn't that be wonderful?
Yeah.
But, you know, as I was reading the reviews and stuff, that's what kept hitting my, you know, I said, okay, so when is this going to become a movie? You know, because it just seems it has the plot, you know, for that, mm-hmm. you know. But it would be quite interesting to find out just how many folks would, you know, talk about it, you know, because I've talked to my daughter, you know, her and I personally, and we've had conversations. You know, my daughter's 39 years old, and she has children of her own, and we have talked about it, and I've asked her, I've said, you know, would you be willing to talk about something if somebody wanted to write? And she said, sure, you know, and she would, you know, so it's like, yeah, I you know, it's just, but I do, I know under the way that society is and all the stuff that's been going on, you know, with the church and all this stuff, especially in California with Proposition 8, I'm sure the conversation there of, you know, homosexuality and all that kind of stuff is like the topic of the day in some places. I mean, you know, with people just keeping up with the news or whatever. But the pro and con, you know, so it's just, I just wonder how people would react to it, you know, if asked, you know, to come, you know, during that Prop 8 and all the demonstrations and stuff, you know, there seemed to be a lot of people that stepped forward that might have been, you know, maybe previous to that were in the closet, or they finally decided to step up because it just seemed that they were going to have their civil rights, you know, and they wanted to be a part of that, so they stepped out. That's what it seemed like to me, anyway. You know, it's interesting. It's interesting. I mean, you know, like anything else, I just feel like, you know, conversations need to be had. Even if, you know, I've always said, even when people, if they don't agree with me, it's okay. I'm not trying to shove my lifestyle down their throat. Okay, but what I ask for them is to respect me the same way I respect them. And we can have that conversation. Okay, we can have the talking about why I'm the way I am and they're the way they are. I mean, it's like, hey, you know. But I believe in having the dialogue.
Yes, exactly, Betty. This is Nancy again. That's why this show is important. That's why Melissa's book about her life and her experience is important. And I'm going to find out where I can rent or buy a copy of Mom's Apple Pie, because I think that the more people share their stories and the more people that come out, it'll become a personal issue to people who right now are against same-sex marriage.
I believe that. I mean, I believe that, you know, if it wasn't, when it comes to all these voting measures that are happening across the states here regarding, the, you know, same-sex marriage and all these other things, I mean, and all the rhetoric that goes on, I mean, the one, I always go back to this thing of, okay, who's planning all this stuff out, but in the votes that have occurred, I believe that right now there is a study out there about Prop 8. And Prop 8 is, they say there was errors made. The vote wasn't counted correctly. They can't, you know, it's machines, it's computers. I really believe that under the system that we live now and under the system that we vote, that no election can be for sure. No vote can be for sure. You know, and computers can be manipulated. We know that. I mean, your home computer can be hacked by anybody out there who understands the system.
Well, I think, too, when things like this are happening, it's hard for us as lesbians and gays to not take it personally. But just having this conversation tonight with you, Melissa, and thank you, Nancy, for bringing all this to light, makes me realize the collateral damage that goes on. I mean, here Melissa, you and your brother, I mean, innocent victims of the homophobic prejudice and how it basically tore apart a family. And so by then telling your story, getting it published, if even just one person, you know, reads it and changes their minds about the broader picture of what these homophobic laws are doing to families across the U.S. and have been doing to families across the U.S. for many, many, many years, not just now, hopefully people's minds can be changed. So that was a very brave thing that you did, but I imagine it was probably just something you also had to do. I mean, just a driving force.
Yes, definitely, and you just put it into words brilliantly. That's exactly why I wrote this book. I wanted to put a human face and a human family on what happens when we let homophobia, you know, dictate public policy. And it's interesting, with my first memoir, Jody Huckabee, the president of PFLAG, was interviewed about it for the Salem Statesman Journal. And he said, Melissa Hart can bring the story that not many want to hear. And I thought, well, darn it, we need to hear it. It's really important.
It's important. You know, like I say, you know, I've told Nancy before, and I've said it before on the show, our straight allies, we don't thank enough. You know, we really forget, you know, and say, oh, golly gee, that was great, you know, and then we go on, you know, but we don't bring it out to the forefront often enough that without the straight allies, you know, we possibly, you know, probably wouldn't be where we are with all the gains that we have done, because it takes, you know, we need our straight allies to get to where we need to be, you know, and like everything else in this life, you can't do anything alone. You know, you have to do it with the participation, the cooperation of others, you know, who are like-minded and believe in fairness and justice, you know, for all people. And you know, and it's and I thank you for being a straight ally. I thank you for telling your story. I thank you. Yeah, you know, because, you know, my version of, you know, raising kids in a lesbian household is a lot different from, you know, the other side of it, that is not so pleasant, okay, and how the law does not protect the mothers and the children. And
have we mentioned how listeners can get the book? Is it purchased through a website or Amazon, or how?
Oh, it's widely available. I should dutifully encourage listeners to order it from their favorite independent bookstore.
There you go. Very good.
And the full title of that is?
It is Gringa, A Contradictory Girlhood, and it's widely available on Powell's and Amazon, and okay. from the local bookstores and from the libraries. And you know, today the American Library Association put Gringa on its 2010 rainbow list of recommended books for LGBT.
Cool.
Wonderful.
Very cool.
Cool yeah. beans. Very good. Very
so,
good.
Melissa, did you get in touch with your Latina side?
I tried very hard.
Okay. oye, muy bienvenida si quieres ser latina.
In the book, Melissa, you had such a passion and love for Latino culture. How did it help define not only your childhood but who you are today?
Well, I have an adopted daughter who's half Costa Rican, and oh. we're just about, she's 3 years old, and we're just about to start learning Spanish together, as my mother
oh,
did with me.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. And, you know, I still have a great, great love for the culture. I finally had to come to terms with the fact that I am not a Latina. I'm just too pale.
Maybe the Latina culture will adopt you.
That's okay. Yes. We're inclusive.
I'm grateful.
I want to thank you. I want to thank Nancy for bringing Melissa to us. It's great, Melissa, having you on the show. I hope we can speak again at a future date and keep up with what you're doing. And that you just call in anytime you wish to join whatever conversation we're having. We stream online at wrfg.org, so you can join us anytime you want.
That sounds terrific.
Okay. All right. Thank you. We have about 3.5 minutes. You can stay on if you want, because I'm just going to talk to the team for a moment and to see what they have to say. Becky, you still there?
I'm still there. I was just thinking, Melissa, I wanted to thank you as well for myself personally, because I remember following the Sharon Bottoms case in Virginia back in the early 90s.
Right.
Another lesbian mom who lost her child, only in this instance it was to her grandmother, or to her mother. The child's grandmother, which was really sad, and that inspired me to paint one of my paintings, Nancy. I think you mentioned Madonna, the Madonna painting. But I wanted to say to you, Melissa, and particularly, how wonderful it is that you took this very sad situation and mined out of it this wonderful, beautiful book that you've written, that you've made something creative, something beautiful out of what some people could have taken and gone in a negative direction with.
Well,
so thank you for doing that as well.
I have to attribute that to my mother, because that's the way she raised us.
Okay. Oh. Cool beans. And our new member in the studio, Bridie, do you have any comments? You want to say anything? How do you want to make any comments about the show itself, you know, and being here?
Yes, it was very interesting being here tonight. Thank you so much. I hope to join every week. And I just wanted to say that I understand in the state of Michigan, me being a foster adoptive parent, it was interesting to me at how in Michigan I could be a foster parent with my partner, but I couldn't adopt a child, which was a permanent structure with my partner, so it kind of reinforces
right.
that still today in certain states, and that's very sad, and I apologize for the bigger community that you had to go through that growing up.
Okay. Donna, any closing statements before we say goodnight?
I just kind of had a big grin on my face the whole time tonight, because it was just really cool to hear this story. And
yes, it was.
To know that that this story is out there and available for folks, and
mm-hmm.
Melissa, it's pretty cool, so thank you. Thanks, Nancy, for finding her.
Right. Thank you, Nancy, and thank you, Becky, for being here, and Melissa, you know, thank you.
And thank you all.
Okay. All right. Good night, ladies.
Good night, Betty. Okay. Night, everyone.
Good night.
Okay. And with that said, thank you out there for listening, and next week we have Reverend Irene Monroe, which I know you don't want to miss, because she is extraordinary, a politician, a reverend, an activist, outspoken. She has opinions on everything. And, you know, it's going to be a great show. She's on for the 45 minutes. So we're going to do our intro stuff and all the little necessary things. And then we're going to get to talking to her. And I'm looking forward to it personally. But until then, good night and buenas noches.